In the matter of State versus Susan Hyland, may we please have appearances?
Good morning, Your Honor. Jennifer King, GS Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the State. Tomorrow,
Good morning, Counsel. Ms. Kamisiak, please go ahead.
Before I begin, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. May it please the Court. In a published decision, the Appellate Division effectively held that non-custodial drug court sentences for otherwise prison-bound offenders are categorically insulated from any appellate review whatsoever, even for clear legal error or for fact findings that are completely unsupported by the record. The Appellate Division's critical error was mistakenly equating the mandatory legal eligibility criteria that are set forth in the statute with the court's assessment of aggravating and mitigating factors, which of course relate only to the length of a sentence that is otherwise legal. To be clear, the state is not arguing today that it has the right to appeal any sentence that, while legal, it believes may be too lenient. Instead, the state is simply asking this court to recognize that the criteria set forth in the special probation statute are in fact mandatory legal eligibility criteria, all of which must be satisfied in order for a special probation sentence to be a legal sentence. If even one of the criteria is not met, the special probation sentence is plainly an illegal sentence. Allowing the state to seek appellate review in appropriate cases serves three critical interests. First, ensuring the legality of special probation sentences. Second, promoting uniformity in sentencing. And third, safeguarding the integrity of the drug court program itself, including the public's confidence in its mission. And particularly in cases where there is victim impact, providing a mechanism for appellate review would provide confidence to the victims, their families, and the general public that there is in fact legal recourse if a judge makes a clear legal error in sentencing a defendant to drug court. This is especially paramount here, where a teenage boy's life was tragically cut short by someone who should never have been on the road that night for a number of reasons, and who fled the scene knowing that she had at least critically injured someone. And this case, in fact, demonstrates the danger in insulating special probation sentences from any review whatsoever. In admitting defendant into drug court, the trial court in this case made critical errors, both legal and factual, in assessing her danger to the community. By citing the fact that defendant would be under intensive supervision in drug court, the trial court effectively rendered this finding meaningless because that applies to all defendants that are applying to be in drug court. And perhaps most troubling, the court gave defendant the benefit of a finding under A3 that her offense was committed under the influence of alcohol, but shielded her from the consequence of that very same finding in A9, the danger to the community analysis. This flawed analysis has the perverse effect of encouraging and in fact rewarding intoxicated drivers who flee the scene of motor vehicle crashes. This unjust result cannot and should not stand. So for all of these reasons, as well as those set forth more fully in the state's supplemental brief, we are asking this court to reverse the decision of the Appellate Division insofar as it held that it did not have jurisdiction to consider even the merits of the state's appeal, and to remand the matter to the Appellate Division so that the merits of the state's appeal can be, in fact, considered.
Are you done with your opening statement?
I am, yes.
Take a look at the 9 factors, if you would. Some of them appear to be purely objective factors, like 6 and 7. You're convicted for a particular offense, or you're not.
Yes.
Others, like 4, like 9, appear to be more discretionary factors that involve judgment calls as to which reasonable people could end up with different conclusions. Are all of them to be treated the same way for purposes of appellate jurisdiction?
Yes. They all should be treated the same way for purposes of the jurisdictional question, whether the state can even appeal and the Appellate Division has jurisdiction to even consider the state's appeal. The state certainly recognizes, as Your Honor is pointing out, that some of the factors are objective, empirical factors, easily answered yes or no by reference to documents, things of that nature, like the person's criminal history. But the fact that some of the factors may have some level of judgment call doesn't mean that the state can't appeal and that there's no jurisdiction. That may go to the standard of review that ultimately the appellate division would consider on the merits of the appeal, but all of the factors, there's 9 factors, the legislature carefully considered what criteria it wanted in allowing people into drug court, and all of the factors should be subject to appellate review, and so the state has a good faith basis for making a claim.
So if a discretionary call by the judge is subject to review,
yes.
What admission decision is not?
The limits on appellate review would be the state is not seeking an end run around the fact that it can't object anymore after 2012, that the state essentially doesn't want the person in drug court, doesn't think they're an appropriate candidate, but they otherwise meet the criteria. So I think that was a faulty premise of the appellate division's decision, that when the legislature in 2012 removed the veto, that meant that the state can never appeal.
Not just the veto, it removed the appeal.
Well, the appeal...
Because the previous iteration of the statute specifically provided a right of appeal, no?
Yes, but the appeal and the veto went together. So, I think this is critical because this really underlined the appellate division's analysis, and it's also, I believe, the argument the defendant is making. So former subsection C, what became known as the veto, held that a person who is subject to sentencing under this section in accordance with subsection A is not eligible if the prosecutor objects. So the state is writing that under its plain language that a person is otherwise eligible, they meet the criteria A1 through 9, and they're not barred under subsection B, and the state could still object. If the state objected, then the burden shifted to the defendant to show a patent and gross abuse of discretion. If the court found that patent and gross abuse of discretion, the state could appeal that. So that was the right to appeal. The statute...
But the legislature could have just continued... State has a right to, no special sentence of special probation imposed shall become final for 10 days in order to permit the appeal of such sentence by the prosecution. Could have kept in that language. That language is in other parts of the criminal code, right?
They certainly could have done that, but the fact that they didn't do that does not mean that the state doesn't have the right to appeal, because we're looking at what the legislature's intent is. So I would make 2 points. First, there's other instances in the code where there's not language that says the state has the right to appeal. So, for example, a NERA sentence. If the judge neglects to impose a mandatory NERA, I don't believe that's in the code that the state can appeal if it's not in there. It's just inherent.
This is where the Chief Justice was talking about violations of law, mm-hmm. things that can be objectively determined,
mm-hmm.
and discretionary determinations mm-hmm. by the trial court. We know there's an objective mistake
mm-hmm.
if a NERA provision has not been imposed. We know that there's an objective mistake if
mm-hmm.
A court has exceeded the bounds of the statute.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, discretionary, absent some specific language in the code giving the
mm-hmm.
state the right to appeal, as discretionary determinations are not appealable by the state. Am I wrong about that?
Discretionary determinations. I would make I would have a couple of responses to that.
Sure.
First of all, the the A1 through 9 are not, none of them are discretionary findings. They are all mandatory findings that have to be made. I think that the fact of objective, or if there's some subjective component to some of them, again, just goes to what the standard of review would be once the court has jurisdiction, but they're all mandatory findings. And I think another point I wanted to make is we're talking about some are objective, some are subjective. At a minimum, the appellate division's opinion doesn't make any distinctions between any of these factors. The appellate division's opinion equates A1 through 9 with aggravating and mitigating factors. So under the appellate division's opinion, at a very minimum, that has to be corrected, that there are objective factors that the court should be able to review.
What do you make of the very strong language, which really is a very different type of language than appears in the aggravating and mitigating factors? No danger to the community will result from the person being placed on special probation pursuant to this section. Do you view that as requiring a finding by the court that almost there will be zero danger to the community from this.
Yes,
and
it's very...
your position, I know from your brief, is this person already killed a young person. This person left the scene of the accident. How can there possibly be a finding that allowing this person to be on special probation, not incarcerated, could pose zero danger to the community?
That is absolutely correct. And kind of dovetailed with that is the fact that time and again, this court and the drug court manual, it's undisputed, drug court is for nonviolent offenders. And it's kind of ironic that the judge here kept saying, yes, this was violence, this was violence, this is the ultimate violence, I think he says at one point. So we have all of those factors Your Honor just cited to, the state is absolutely relying on to show she is a danger to the community. And I think the burden is important as well, and we put this in our brief. The burden should be on the defendant to prove all of these factors. Because under 2C113D, the burden, when it's not an element of the offense, which this is not, this is a sentencing scheme, the burden is on the party whose interest is furthered.
Well, would you agree that 7 out of 9 of them, and the Chief pointed out 4 and 9 are really kind of different, 7 out of 9 of them are really, you could read the pre-sentence report, it almost doesn't matter whose burden it is, it either is true or not true.
I think that would be correct.
That's really almost a question. And of course, there's nothing in, we don't know what the burden's supposed to be, but your position would be that it's, that as to these sort of predictive factors, it should be the defendant's burden?
Yes, absolutely. It should be the defendant's burden, and that was not satisfied here.
But isn't that argument really, when you think about it in the context of aggravating and mitigating factors, the same argument the state would be able to now make under a claim of illegal sentence anytime it was dissatisfied with the sentence imposed by a court within a legitimate range?
No, Your Honor, because aggravating and mitigating factors only go to the range of a sentence that is otherwise authorized by law. So, you know, if it's a second-degree crime, 5 to 10 years, the state was seeking 10, and the judge gave, you know, 7 or 8.
I'm suggesting that your argument is expanding what is and is not an illegal sentence.
I understand Your Honor's concern, but the legislature made very clear that A1 through 9 have to be satisfied. And if a judge makes a clear legal error on any of those findings, or it's unsupported by the record, we're undermining the legislature's intent by not having the ability to even review. And all we're talking about is appellate review. The state may not win in every case, but in fact, you know, to the extent the court is concerned this will open the floodgates for appeals, I would say in 2012, when the legislature removed the veto, and the Attorney General issued a memorandum to county prosecutors advising that don't sit back, do not be idle spectators in the process. You still have a critical role here to ensure that the law is followed, and that includes an appeal when necessary. We haven't
seen...
But if
the legislature meant what you say it meant, wouldn't it have included something like the language in subsection J, where it allowed a limited time for the prosecution to bring an appeal? Because it was concerned about the interference that appeal time would take for the commencement of the commitment process.
The legislature certainly...
That's talking about a residential treatment facility. Mm-hmm. It's a different context, I know, but the legislature had in this same section language where it was carving out a way for the state to bring a limited and very quick appeal to get review of something that the legislature intended to be permitted to be appealed, and we don't have that for this section now in light of the legislative action in 2012.
We don't have any specific language that says the state can appeal, but I think to not allow an appeal undermines the legislature's intent, because the legislature carefully considered these 9 criteria and decided these criteria have to be met in order for a person to be an appropriate candidate for a special probation sentence.
So carry over your argument to some of the questions that Justice Levesque asked earlier. Take a typical fourth or third degree.
Mm-hmm.
Our law says that there has to be sufficient credible evidence to find an aggravating factor or a mitigating factor. So let's say the court has failed to do that. It has erred.
Mm-hmm.
Are you arguing that in third and fourth degree cases that those errors can be appealed
No.
by the state?
No, I'm not, and I think that's the important distinction here, because The sentence that would ultimately be imposed, even if the judge made some fine misapplication of aggravating and mitigating factors, would still be an authorized sentence under our code.
Even though the judge may have clearly erred in not finding an appropriate aggravating factor, or
yes,
inappropriately finding a mitigating factor, mm-hmm, you're conceding that because our code says you have no right to an appeal, you just can't appeal that.
Yeah, the state accepts that, and the case law is clear on that. The state accepts that, but that is a different situation than here, where there's no aggravating and mitigating factors don't have to be, there's no mandatory findings associated with them. But here, the legislature has determined that A1 through 9 all have to be considered and all have to be found. Every single one of these factors has to be found.
Well, I disagree with you, because we have specifically said, with respect to a mitigating factor, if there is sufficient credible evidence to support a mitigating factor, it must be found. We've said that.
Well, and the defendant can appeal that, and that's, you know, the state recognizes that, and defendants do appeal that all the time.
We don't permit, I don't think, judicial nullification, that a judge can find sufficient credible evidence for an aggravating factor, but I'm not going to find that. We wouldn't tolerate that.
We wouldn't tolerate that. I don't know how the state would actually appeal that.
You might not, but
right,
be able to appeal it. But there's certainly no legal basis for a judge to nullify what is required upon a sufficient findings of fact. Would you agree?
I would agree that that would not be appropriate. But
your argument is that's a balancing test.
Yes.
That there is a lot more leeway granted by the legislature,
yes,
to courts in that.
Yes.
But this is, the word and appears after every subsection here.
Yes.
All nine must be found. You have two that are involved judgment.
Yes.
And that those two still are sufficiently objective that if there isn't a basis for it, this becomes an illegal sentence.
Yes, absolutely. That would be our position. And I think that's supported by the statute and the legislature's intent to make sure that only appropriate candidates are put into drug court. And I think we put in our brief, just to give the court some examples of what will happen if we cannot have appellate review, three appeals, one published case and two unpublished cases, where the state was actually successful in all of those appeals, where we had judges that made mistakes. In State versus Ancrum, a published case, I believe that was the case where a judge determined that because something merged, it was not disqualifying anymore.
But that was an objective factor. Went to one.
That was an objective factor, sure. Then there was State versus Garina, an unpublished case, which dealt with the danger to the community under a Track 2 case. The appellate division remanded for the judge to make findings on whether there'd be a danger to the community. And I think that's important because, again, it goes to the standard of review. Perhaps we may have a judge who doesn't make any findings on one of these factors. Then what happens? If the judge just, you know, goes through some of the factors and refuses or neglects to make a finding on danger to the community, well, then the legislature's intent has not been satisfied.
But here you agree that the judge did find no danger to the community.
He did make that finding.
And I take it it's your, and you, I think, agree that that might be a discretionary call, not an objective call.
There's some level of discretion involved.
And that might be reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard.
Yeah, it's going to depend on what the state is alleging. So if there's no finding at all, then it would be...
But in this case?
In this case, it's a mixed question, actually, in this case. It's kind of interesting because what the judge actually said was, first of all, I think this is the legal piece of it. He said, well, I have to look at it in the fact that she's going to be under intensive supervision in drug court. And the state is saying that that is not the appropriate legal framework because that applies to everyone. Everyone is going to be under intensive supervision. But it's still a non-custodial sentence, and it's on the record. She was going to Integrity House. There's not bars there, you know. And once you're out of the inpatient treatment, it's a non-custodial sentence.
Okay, so that might be a legal error that you,
yes,
claim renders this an illegal sentence, and therefore you have a right to appeal.
Absolutely.
What about where it's not that finding, but just discretion is exercised by the court, and they conclude, based on the totality,
mm-hmm,
the nature of the individual, their background, their history,
mm-hmm,
they're very amenable to treatment, I find, as an exercise of,
mm-hmm,
my discretion, that they are not a danger to the community. Is that also appealable as an illegal sentence?
It's always going to be appealable if the state submits and it is not satisfied.
And that would be an abuse of discretion standard, but you would have the ability to appeal because you're appealing it as an illegal sentence, which the appellate division would have jurisdiction to hear.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the whole argument.
Yes, and I think Your Honor's second hypothetical sounds more something that would be akin to an abuse of discretion. And the state may not appeal in that case. You know, that's, you know, we advise prosecutors all the time on different, you know, they call us and ask us for advice, and that may be a case where the state wouldn't appeal.
But getting
it
back
would
to what Justice Patterson said, the reason you contend it's an illegal sentence is because you have to find, it's set, the legislature's made it clear, you have to find all nine.
Yes.
And if you don't, if you abuse your discretion in finding one, or you find one where objectively it can't mm-hmm. be found,
yes,
then it's an illegal sentence and you have a right to appeal.
Absolutely.
How does that, how is that affected by the legislature's obvious intent to deprive the state of that 10-day appeal filing process and implicitly say, no, it's not appealable?
So this is an important point because the legislature removed the prosecutor's ability to object, but the ability to object because a person who is otherwise eligible, the prosecutor could object to. So that's where the objection would come in. The prosecutor, you know, the prosecutor agrees that A1 through 9 are met or isn't going to, wouldn't appeal on that basis, but otherwise objects. So the prosecutor otherwise has this objection that's not based on the eligibility criteria, and then the prosecutor could appeal if the judge nevertheless admits the person into drug court. But that's different than whether they're even eligible in the first instance. So
let's
like
take
two
this
layers.
Case. Let's say yes. The eligibility criteria were objectively found there. Under the old law, before mm-hmm. the amendment, you would have a right to, the prosecutor would have a right to object even after all nine factors were found.
Yes.
Even if the court just clearly did everything perfectly and found all mm-hmm. the objections. So you're saying the impact of that amendment was mm-hmm. at a different stage than this.
Yes. That would be like the second stage. First, you have to meet, I think it would be two steps. First, does the defendant meet A1 through 9, and are they not excluded under B? If all that is met, then the state could object. But if A1 through 9 are not met, we don't even have to get to objection because the state should be making arguments and the judge should be making findings on A1 through 9. If any one of those is not met, there's no need for the state to object or even appeal.
Let me ask you about 9, one sort of not quite related question, but about 9, because you were arguing that if the judge was right that intensive supervision means there's no danger,
mm-hmm.
then just about anybody who got into drug court would satisfy 9 because they're in intensive supervision,
yes.
therefore there's no danger, 9 wouldn't mean very much. Can the court look at what are the conditions under which this person is going to live going forward in deciding whether or not they're going to be a danger to the community?
I think the court may be able to look at that, but I mean, I think the bottom line is it's still a non-custodial sentence, so I don't think that really should be given much weight, because I think the court has to look at this is a non-custodial sentence, and the court should also be looking at what is the nature of the offense that's being alleged, and also the person's prior history. And here we have a defendant who's out, as Your Honor noted, drinking, driving on a suspended license, should never have been on the road to begin with, strikes this teenage boy, flees the scene, talks about burning the car, the evidence, tries to flee again. I mean, to say that's not a danger to the community is
Are there conditions for special probation that could mm-hmm. be imposed that would neutralize the potential danger of this defendant to the community?
I don't believe there are. I mean, special probation will, the defendant will have their task evaluation and the treatment will go from there, and you know, if it's inpatient, I mean, that would be the highest level of monitoring. But in any event, they're not physically kept in their treatment facility just by the nature of.
But if they relapse in their treatment facility, they're mm-hmm. out.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If they relapse
yes.
in the treatment facility while under drug court,
right.
they're out.
Well, perhaps. I mean, they can have some violations before they'll be permanently revoked from special probation. But, I mean, I think the danger would be, you know, first of all, you could walk out of the facility. Second of all, while the person, after they complete the inpatient treatment, and then they're out on the streets. I mean, what's to stop? That's why we have to look.
No,
at
no.
The
I meant that they're out of drug court. They're out of the entire incubation that drug court provides. And that if you fail, and very often they do, they're out and they're sentenced.
Right. Well, they don't. One failure or one relapse is not necessarily enough for a person to be revoked from drug court.
Or even two, right? Even more than
one. Yeah, I think it's under subsection F, there's like a presumption that upon a first violation, the court in its discretion may revoke special probation, so may, but not always. And I mean, from
Justice Kimball wasn't talking about a relapse. He's talking about someone absconding from a residential facility.
Okay. That's what I understand Your Honor's point. Yes, but the danger may have already happened if someone absconds and is out driving again and does the same thing.
That could happen for any person who's in drug court. Tell me, if we were to accept your argument, what would happen to the person who had been admitted to drug court during the period of appeal? No drug court? Barred?
You're saying someone already started the program? I think that, yeah.
Even if they haven't started, trial court admits the person into drug court, finding the person will benefit from the program and is in desperate need of this type of rehabilitation. Upon the state's appeal, what happens in your estimation?
Well, I mean, the state can seek a stay of that sentence, which was done here. The state.
So that means that the person would be in limbo for a period of a year, at least.
I mean, they could. Well, I mean, like what happened here. Actually, she went into treatment and started treatment. It wasn't considered drug court, but to say that she's getting no treatment for the whole time was not even the case here. She actually went into Integrity House and started treatment.
But I want to understand what you're arguing and what you think should be the format going forward.
Okay.
It would be to stay the sentence and deny the person the opportunity of going into drug court and receiving whatever benefits it provides?
Yes. I mean, if drug court is not a legal sentence, they should not be entering drug court. The state would be expected to move quickly, like what happened in this case. The state filed the notice of appeal immediately. Perhaps some of these cases could be decided on the SOA calendar very quickly, depending on the nature of if there's briefing needed or not. It doesn't have to be a long appeal process necessarily. I mean, that's out of the state's control somewhat, but it doesn't have to necessarily be a long appeal process. If the person is not an appropriate candidate for drug court, they're not an appropriate candidate for drug court. And that would be the state's position on that.
Can we go back to factor 9 for a second? And this is a general question, not based on the facts of this case, but the principle as a whole.
Okay.
No danger to the community will result, as Justice Patterson pointed out, is a very high standard.
Mm-hmm.
It requires that we predict future behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it can never be a guarantee.
Yes.
Does that mean that every time a judge finds Section 9, you can appeal?
Anytime a judge finds Section 9 and the state believes that there was clear legal error or it's unsupported by the record, the state has the ability to appeal and the appellate division has jurisdiction. That goes to the standard of review.
Is it legal error to say the judge couldn't conclude this because we, of course, know there's no guarantees in any case that there'll be no danger?
I think the state would have to point to more than that. Than just, we think everybody's, that would kind of be in the opposite direction. The judge thinks that no one's a danger to the community because they're going to be under intensive supervision. If the state were to say, everybody who has a criminal record is a danger to the community, that's not what the state is seeking. It has to be tied to the facts of the case, what the judge actually says, and all we're seeking is appellate review. That's appellate review, this court time and again has talked about the importance of appellate review, and we understand the state is limited in seeking appellate review, and defendants have more rights to seek appellate review, but the state has the responsibility to ensure that the law is followed. And
so we're clear. This isn't, we're just interpreting the statute. We're not superimposing, whatever we decide is not superimposing some sort of judicial policy. I'm just trying to figure out what the legislature intended, correct?
Correct.
Nothing more than that.
Yes. Well, the question before the court, I would totally agree, is did the legislature intend for these 9 factors to be completely unreviewable? And the answer to that is clearly no. There has to be some mechanism for review, because it leads to absurd results and it undermines the legislature's intent to have these factors weigh heavily and be the sole factors that courts must find in order to place a defendant on special probation. And we have to keep in mind, these are defendants who are otherwise facing the presumption of imprisonment. So, I mean, just to give an analogy, and I understand there's no explicit right to appeal, but even a downgraded sentence, the state can appeal. So that's even still going to jail. This is a person not having a non-custodial sentence, and we have to ensure that only appropriate people are allowed into the program.
Do you agree that, assuming there is, that this can be considered an illegal sentence, at least the state's position?
Yes.
That 9's not met, if they're not all met, it's an illegal sentence. Illegal sentence, you may appeal. How high is the bar for the state?
In terms of the merits of the appeal?
Yes.
It will depend on what the nature of the error alleged is. I mean, if it's the judge some cases will be easy, and the one
case. How about
case,
this factor 9?
Factor 9.
Where is the bar? Is it an abuse of discretion standard like every other abuse of discretion appeal,
mm-hmm.
or is it something else or higher?
Well, it will depend on it is kind of fact specific. I think no danger to the community is somewhat of a mixed question of law and fact. And here, I think the state's bar is lower because the judge just imposed the standard that doesn't make sense, that everyone's under intensive supervision, so therefore I don't find that she's going to be a danger to the community.
Isn't there an argument that your burden is higher on 4 and 9 than it would be on, let's say 5, which is about a firearm? There either was or wasn't in the police report a mention mm-hmm. of a firearm, right? That mm-hmm. seems to be pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. But isn't there an argument that your burden would be higher on 4 and 9 because of the sort of judgment discretionary mm-hmm. component of those two factors?
I think the burden is perhaps different. Some of these factors are easily, the state can easily show them. So the burden, even if you call it abuse of discretion, de novo, whatever standard of review we apply. For example, in the one case we cited in our appendix, the judge realized the defendant had, and this was a Track 2 case, realized the defendant had a disqualifying aggravated assault conviction, but said, that's ancient history, I think he should get into drug court. And that's an easy case for the state to meet its burden, because the appellate division said, well, there's no time limits on it, and the appellate division said that's an illegal sentence. And so we would ask this court to look at that case. I believe it's State versus DeGroote. In our appendix, and that's a Track 2 case.
Well, what about the last factor in SN, a clear error in judgment?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be an appropriate standard?
Yes, that standard would, I think, fit this type of scenario, because a clear error in judgment could be disregarding a person's criminal history, it could be applying the wrong legal standard. I think that standard would fit a lot of these types of cases.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lehrer.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'd like to take a step back and just get into some black letter sentencing jurisprudence from this Court. There are only 2 ways for the state to appeal a sentence. The first is explicit statutory authorization. The downgrade statute is a very good example of that. There used to be explicit statutory authorization to appeal a drug court sentence. That explicit statutory authorization was repealed in 2012. It was repealed because in 2012, the legislature sought to expand Drug Court, which is a vital and successful program. And one of the ways that it did that was by expanding judicial discretion. And one of the ways it did that was by insulating acts of judicial discretion from prosecutorial interference. Yes, there was a veto then, but the effect is exactly the same. The only way a defendant could get in with the prosecutor objected was over the veto, and then the prosecutor could appeal. Here, we don't have a veto anymore, so the only way the defendant can get in over the prosecutor's objection is if the trial court uses its discretion to put the defendant in. But, as one of your honors pointed out, the legislature could have easily kept the appeal provision. The state acknowledges that this provision was appealed and yet is seeking judicial review of what the legislature explicitly removed judicial review of. The second way a sentence can be appealed is if it's illegal, and that's really why we're here. So that category has always been defined narrowly. The state here argues that the sentence is illegal because the court abused its discretion in making certain findings. That argument conflates two entirely different concepts, illegality and abuse of discretion. Abuse of discretion is relevant during discretionary sentencing calls. Whether or not something is legal is not discretionary. It's a pure question of law, and it can't be changed through trial court findings. So Schubert, I think, gave the clearest definition of what an illegal sentence is. Those that are not in accordance with the law or stated differently, those that include a disposition that is not authorized by our criminal code.
So let's take the factors, and let's just say there is, the court just blows it as
yes.
to factor one, there has not been an evaluation or an assessment in accordance with the factor. The judge is confusing two different cases, right?
So
finds that there is no assessment. Is that an illegal sentence?
So I put forward two constructs of what an illegal sentence is in my brief. The answer to question depends on which one is picked up. So the first one that I put forward is these objective per se legal determinations. So that's A6, A7, and B. The reason I picked that is because that is what hews most traditionally to our notion of whether something is an illegal sentence. And
you're talking about factors 6 and 7?
A6, 7, and 14B. Those are objective legal per se determinations. And prior history and current convictions have always been the way that we did the courts look to see whether a sentence is illegal. And I'd like to reason by analogy for a moment, which I think might be clarifying, if you would permit. Let's consider the discretionary persistent offender statute, so 2C44(3). Imagine someone is convicted of a second degree offense, usually 5 to 10. It's undisputed based on JOCs that are already in the judge's hands that this person is eligible for a persistent offender discretionary term. The judge makes no findings either about the history or about where in the range the appropriate sentence is based on aggravating and mitigating factors. Person gets a 17. On direct appeal, the person would probably get a remand, right? Because not considering aggravating and mitigating factors is an abuse of discretion. But let's say for a second that person doesn't appeal, and that person files a motion for to correct an illegal sentence way out of time later, because that can be filed at any point. I think this court would say, the way it said in Acevedo about consecutives, this is a disposition authorized by the code, because given the conviction, second degree, and the prior history, 5 to 20 is the range, so 17 is not an illegal sentence, though it was imposed inappropriately. And that's basically what happened with Acevedo with consecutives. And I think it's important when you look at the language of 44(3), there's mandatory language there too, that the court can only sentence someone to a persistent offender extended term if it finds one or more of the grounds are met. So I would suggest that there's a lot of mandatory language both in statutes and in case law about how judges have to use their discretion, how it's wielded. But this court has never said that the failure to do those things makes a sentence illegal. It always looks at prior criminal history and current charges.
I was just going to ask, what if the trial court gave no statement of reasons for placing someone in drug court, didn't articulate reasons for 9 and many of the other factors? Would the state have a right to appeal?
In my first construct of illegality, no. In the second one, which is the other kind of option, I think is the only other reasonable option, making each finding of the 9 and subsection B, the mere fact of finding is what is required to make the sentence legal, that we can't plumb the discretion of making those findings, but we could require those findings to be made.
What if the finding is wholly inadequate? And, for example, if a judge were to say, in a case like this, you know, I've looked at the record, I think this person can be redeemed, period, and therefore I find factor 9.
I believe that as long as the finding is made, we cannot plumb the judge's use of his discretion. However, there are still ways for some amount of review. So under either schema, sentences that are illegal, actually illegal, Ankrum, there was a disqualifying conviction under subsection B, right? Mm-hmm. There can still be appealed. So depending on which construct this court chooses.
How about the discretionary clause, 4 and 9?
I don't think that there is any interpretation of what an illegal sentence is that allows this court or any court to say, I don't agree with the trial court's use of discretion here. It's conflating.
So you're not disputing Ankrum. That's an objective finding as to the ramifications mm-hmm. of the defendant's prior record. Clearly an error was made. It seems, you know, obviously, from the analysis of the court in that case. You are not contesting that if an error like that is made, the state can appeal to flag that for an appellate court.
Right.
There's not really a lot of judgment call here.
Even under my more narrow, what mm-hmm. I would submit as the more correct version of legality, mm-hmm. I don't dispute Ankrum. I'd like to make two points.
In this case particularly, was there even any discussion about the prior criminal history? Because the defendant had 6 convictions in Superior Court, 11 convictions in Municipal Court, and what the trial judge said, most applicants have long criminal histories. Is that an appropriate assessment or a non-assessment?
I'd like to make 2 points about Ankrum and then answer your question, if that's
sure.
all right. 2 points about Ankrum.
Okay.
The presiding judge of the Appellate Division, Judge Masano, was on both Ankrum and Highland. So I think when the state says the Appellate Division thinks trial court sentences are never reviewable, that's not what the Appellate Division thinks. The same judges are looking at these sentences and trying to decide when they are reviewable and when they are not. The second point I'd like to make about Ankrum is that it was on motion for leave to appeal, as was Garena and as was DeGroat, I'm pretty sure. There are situations where the interests of justice will require an appeal. The state here did not pursue a motion for leave to appeal. That is exercised sparingly, but Meyer, this court's drug court case, Seminole, was also an interlock. So there are situations where if the state can explain why this specific use of discretion perhaps necessitates review, I don't dispute that interlocutory review is possible. It's just highly discretionary and used sparingly.
How about firearms?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Answer a question.
That one's easier, so can I start there and then go there?
It's always easier coming from me.
I know firearms sounds like an objective call. I have read drug court appeals by defendants when they are disputing whether or not there was a firearm, because the PSR says yes, and they say no. Their friend says no. This witness says no. It's not objective.
Okay.
I will concede 2 things. The first is that whether or not there's a task evaluation is the closest other one to whether something is objective.
Right.
So if this court decided, we agree that we need a more narrow view of legality, but certain things are actually literally yes, no, in, out, one is closer. The reason I didn't include it is because traditionally we look at prior criminal history and current convictions to decide legality. The second thing I'd like to say is to imagine a situation maybe where an interlock would be granted on the gun factor. The trial court finds, because usually there's a finding of eligibility before the day of the plea, that there was no gun. Then the defendant gives a factual basis and says, I possessed a gun, I used a gun. That's probably a good moment for an interlock. It's before sentencing. The state cannot appeal the sentence, but at that very moment, the state can say, the basis for the finding of eligibility has been undermined. We need to appeal the sentence. So I want to push back against this notion that there's nothing anyone can do about anything. There are mechanisms, there are rules, and there's proper ways to do it. The state here had 6 weeks between the day that the legal ruling was made mm-hmm. and the plea, let alone the sentence. There was time for this.
So if you had a guilty plea and there's an admission to a firearm, at that moment you have an illegal sentence. If the court is about to sentence or admit the defendant to drug court, and there's an admission of a firearm, that would make it illegal.
I am not ready to say it would make it illegal because the judge still used his discretion in reviewing the discovery. But at that moment, the state has a really good argument under 2:2-4 that the interests of justice require an intervention because the findings the trial court made have been thoroughly undermined. Yes. Okay. Yes. So
it's okay.
I will point to in 1T on page 17, 4T page 6, and 6T, which is about bail, page 75, so I don't want to hide the ball about that. It is a different motion. The trial court did consider her prior criminal history. It considered that the indictables are rather remote. They were all, I think, theft offenses. I do have them here. That the last indictable was in 2000, and that none of her prior convictions at all involved intentional infliction of
violence. I was referring specifically to the comment that most people who come to drug court have a history of disregarding the law, and most applicants have long criminal history. So that was his assessment of this particular defendant's criminal history.
Well, that
was that a non-assessment because it's just a general comment that people have a history? Can we say that there was no assessment here based on that?
But why two not? Things. The first is that the trial court said a number of things, and that was one of the things he said. But on the pages I just mentioned, the trial court looked at the criminal history in more detail and said other things. The second thing is, this brings me back to why we trust judges to use their discretion. The judge here was the presiding trial court judge for years, right? He has developed the special competence that this court has said over and over again. Trial courts develop specific competences in specific areas, but specifically a drug court judge who's admitting people and then seeing how they do does have a different perspective on what a particular, what your average drug court applicant looks like and what your average person who succeeds in drug court looks like, what that history looks like. So I think this is exactly why this is not an illegal sentence, why the abuse of discretion is this different story, because this is what trial courts do.
I did not follow your argument about interlocutory appeals. What are you saying?
I think that in
Are you suggesting that you could make a motion for leave to appeal on a discretionary factor, but you couldn't do it, but you couldn't do it from a final judgment?
So appealing sentences is different black letter law than appealing interlocutory decisions. So the state can't appeal legal sentences, period. I think what Meyer shows us and what Ankrum shows us is that this court and the appellate division can discretionarily grant a motion for leave to appeal.
What does that mean? First of all, is admission into drug court a final judgment?
I don't think it is.
Okay. Then that means that all appeals would be interlocutory.
But so the difference between an interlocutory appeal and the state's appeal here is that it's highly discretionary.
Look, if you don't... From your perspective, you either have a right to an appeal or you don't have a right to appeal, whether it's interlocutory or from a final judgment. Or are you saying something different?
I thought the most reasonable position here was to separate appeals from a sentence, which is a specific final judgment that this court has said over decades is not appealable absent illegality or statutory right, and the highly limited, to be used only sparingly, in the words of Reldin, ability for the state to seek review of interlocutory.
Okay, so let me try to understand. I'm trying to make sense of what you're arguing here. Are you then conceding that the state, on a motion for leave to appeal, can challenge number 9?
I think it could try, and I think it would generally be inappropriate to grant.
Okay, so no. So now the appellate division grants leave to appeal. Now you're saying that the appellate division can review number 9, or this court can review number 9, we can grant leave to appeal.
I would be very happy if this court said admission or sentence, it's the same thing, it's not reviewable. However, based on my reading of Ankrum, which is just an appellate division decision, and also about this per se bar.
So, look, if an appellate court thinks that the trial court is wrong on number, like way off the mark on number 9, it's going to grant leave to appeal and do something about it.
Right.
So it seems to undermine the entire argument that you began with before this court.
I think that's a very real danger. When I, discuss with my office, what do we think of this interlock thing? We felt like we could not say There's literally no way to ever interlocutory appeal, but it...
And yet that's the only pathway for appeal. So you seem to be conceding there's a right to appeal by motion for leave to appeal.
There's a right to request an appeal through motion for leave to appeal.
It's a motion for leave to appeal. If the appellate court finds that there's some gross mistake, it's going to grant it, and then it seems to me that you're not too far from the state.
I'm not saying it's not dangerous. It's not something that concerns me, and the appellate division has a lot of discretion about when to grant motions for leave to appeal, and I would hope that the interest of justice standard was not going to be read as, I just disagree with what the trial court
did. Are you trying to have a more purist approach to what is in the legal sentence that's capable of an automatic right of appeal and keep that to the side, and that's why you're urging us to focus on the MLA approach?
I am. And okay. I think MLA should be very rarely granted. I don't get them granted very often, right? Mm-hmm. I understand that they're a different beast. That's different than what's happened in this case, which is an appeal. They just filed a notice for appeal the way I do after my client gets a sentence he doesn't like. Went all the way through the system, right? It's been over 2 years. That's an incredibly different beast than something really special requires the appellate court to intervene.
Would you explain where in the sequence in a drug court, I just don't entirely understand where the time frame is where a decision would have been made and yet it's still interlocutory. See my concern?
In this case, on December 8th, I think, though I can check, there was a trial court ruling that she was legally eligible at some point in December.
So the legally eligible, it's the time frame between legally eligible and the actual disposition.
I would suggest that that is.
And what, as a practical matter, in the real world, how fast does that happen?
That was 6 weeks.
In this case,
until the plea, and then more. I'm sorry, I don't have the date.
So it's still interlocutory when there's a finding of eligibility under the nine factors, but it becomes final?
Oh, here's December 9th to January 20th.
Okay.
My understanding of the black letter law, and I'd be happy to be wrong in some aspects, is that sentences are final judgments, and the state cannot appeal them absent illegality or statutory authorization. Other things the trial court says, same thing when the state wants to appeal a denial of 404B evidence at trial. Other rulings the trial court
so
makes.
I'm trying, since if we all agree that this is a motion for leave to appeal and not an appeal from a final judgment, then that is the pathway for attacking any of these factors.
So this is not a motion for leave to appeal.
Why not?
Because there was a final sentence and then the state filed a notice for appeal. This court has a different discretionary call. But the appellate division did not use its discretion to decide whether a motion for
What's a final sentence? The person was entered into that's why I asked you, is admission into drug court, which is a sentence,
no.
A final judgment?
The sentencing. My conception was the sentencing date, which here was February 27th.
But is it really a final judgment as Justice Tim Palm was pointing out, when if somebody relapses in drug court, they are sentenced.
They're resentenced. The way that SOAs work, when you get your first sentence, that's a sentence that you can appeal.
Okay.
That's a final notice. Final.
I understand there was a period of weeks in between the admission decision and the sentence to drug court in this case, and perhaps the state can help us as well. Is that always the case?
I tend to see.
Are there instances where a judge can make the determination, you're eligible and I'm going to impose sentence today?
I tend to see, you still need a plea, right? So I think at the very least you'd have eligibility finding plea on one day and then sentencing. I've never seen it all happen in one day. Because pleas and sentences, I don't think I ever take, some trial judges here, but.
A drug court sentence is like a probationary sentence. It's conditional freedom. I mean, if you violate probation, and a probationary sentence is a final judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But if you violate probation, you're going to be resentenced and sent to the can.
But you can also,
The same is true of drug court.
Yeah, and I think, so two things. Probationary sentence is a final judgment. This is a final judgment. You can appeal how many years of probation you get. I do that on the SOA a lot. You know, the defendant got 4 years, wanted 3 years. That's an appealable final judgment. I think the fact that when you mess up drug court, you're thrown, depending on how severely and how many times, you go into prison is an important point here. She pleaded guilty to something that carries a max of 10 years. When you think about what the danger to the community is, she wasn't just simply let to walk. She was put into this rigorous program that has a lot of supervision, and that if she messes up, she pleaded open. There's not even an alternative sentence. she's eligible for a lot of time.
Let me just clarify, because I think you answered a question that I had earlier of the prosecutor. In the event that it is an interest of justice appeal under the rule, it's a motion, it meets the standard, that's a very high bar, and
yes.
We have discretion to grant or not grant.
That is probably the word I should have used before. The reason it's different than appealing a sentence is that it's a very, very high bar.
So when I ask the question, what is the bar? At what point can the state say, whoa, wait a minute, all these factors have to be found. This one was found, but it's, you know, a bizarre result. In the interest of justice, somebody has to take a look at this. They would have the option of filing that interlocutory appeal, that motion.
Yes, and I would suggest, I would hope, that this is not the one that would be granted. I would hope the one that's granted is the plea undercut the finding that there was something, that it's not about the trial court's use of their discretion to the same degree.
But you're at least answering the question that it could happen. It's just a very, very high bar. And it's discretionary.
That's my understanding. Again, I'm not going to fight this court.
You're not fighting me. You may be fighting somebody else.
That was what was the most reasonable conclusion that we came to. But we have...
So I'm going to ask, because I'm not certain what the answer is. So forgive me.
Uh-oh.
Is a trial court sentence a final judgment?
Yeah.
Yes?
A trial court, the day it imposes sentence? Yes.
The day it imposes...
That JOC?
It admits someone into... tell me if I'm mistaken. When a person is sentenced to drug court, it's a judgment of conviction. That's a final judgment.
Right.
So then tell me where the motion for leave to appeal comes into play.
I think in this case, and this is what happened in Ankrum and maybe even Green, it was the day after the court said on the record, I find that this person is legally eligible for drug court. It was a finding on the record.
But just to be clear, when I asked you, I'm sorry.
On thought of sentencing, it's interlocutory. You have a fine day where you make your findings. Then generally, the plea could be that day or day after or soon thereafter, but it's not final until the court enters a sentence to drug court. So during that period of time, it's reviewable, but not after the court sentence.
It's a very high bar for review during that time.
But still, it could be reviewed.
It could be. It's not reviewable in the same way as...
Not as a matter of right, but
yeah.
It could be reviewed.
Is there anything in the statute, and that's what I should have articulated this more sharply, is there anything in the statute that requires the judge to do this in two stages?
No. I have literally never seen someone plead guilty and be sentenced on the same day.
I'm not saying plead guilty.
Well,
I'm talking about the findings.
Someone wouldn't plead guilty until they have... They know about their drug court eligibility, because obviously that changes. You go from 5 to 10 to drug court to 10.
Right.
We have two former trial court judges on the bench, so they might know.
No one's going to plead guilty until they know whether they're admitted to drug court or not, or they're eligible.
Right.
So there's going to be a natural time lag between, because the plea is not going to be the same day as the sentence. The plea is not going to happen until the drug court eligibility finding is made by the court.
Right. And I see that this idea of interlocks has some traction. I really do want to emphasize that highly sparingly, highly discretionary.
But the judge is not going to make, if this is anything like a typical sentencing, the judges will not make his findings until the day of sentence, day on which he will or she will enter the judgment of conviction.
I think generally what we see with drug court is that because there are these other factors, there's usually a separate hearing. Sometimes it's a different judge. There's the drug court judge. It gets sent there for the drug court judge to make some findings. So I think there's a different kind of process here with drug court. But even then, because someone's not going to plead guilty until they know if they're eligible, there's going to be a day where the trial court says, I'm not necessarily going to put you on drug court, but I find that you could be put on drug court.
And would the judge then go through the 9 factors?
You'd hope so. That's what happened here.
Yeah, what happened here.
Yeah.
So under Section A, a judge also has the ability to impose special probation, impose drug court probation on the court's own motion.
Yes. 3514.A?
Yeah.
Yes.
That could present a challenge. It's from a practical perspective, I don't think it happens that often, but that could limit you to about an hour.
It's a separate statute, right? So it's 14.A, right, is this other, it's the next step, right?
No, it's 14, Section A.
Section A. Oh, on the court's motion. Right,
right before the factors.
You'd assume, I thought you meant mandatory drug court under the next subsection. You'd assume the drug court, at the trial court at some point has to say, I am considering putting you on drug court because I think you might be eligible, go forth to your task evaluation, because you still need to have that evaluation. Stuff has to happen. Not, I know that's a very legal...
Okay.
But there's a lot that goes on.
Yeah, we'll hear a little more from the state on this. Is there anything else you wanted to present?
I want to say three things, and I'll say them quickly. The first, just again about emphasizing how this concept of abuse of discretion is different from legality, I just think there's some really good language in State v. Ellis, which is an appellate division case, 346 NJ Super 583, but this court quoted with approval in Acevedo. And the court said, when reviewing a sentence for legality, quote, we do not now address the wisdom of the sentence or test it against the norms of judicial discretion. What the state is asking here is for this court to test this sentence against the norms of judicial discretion, and that's what we don't do in legality review. The second point I want to make is that I want to point this court to what it said in Clark with an E, because there are two Clarks that have been cited, 203 New Jersey 166. Whether to approve an application for admission to the drug court program is essentially a sentencing decision. This court said that a few times in Clark. And the reason that's really important is that it brings me to my third point. There is nothing different between how the trial court uses its discretion to sentence to drug court and how it uses its discretion to sentence to custodial terms. And regardless of what the state says about how narrow this ask is not narrow. So to imagine an ordinary sentence where, let's say the trial court undercuts the state, there's a plea bargain, state says 8, trial court gives 6, finds mitigating factor 7. Looks objective, right? Doesn't have a criminal record or has led a law-abiding life for a substantial period of time. That looks like an objective factor. And then the state says, they use the wrong substantial. That's not what substantial means. Substantial has to mean more than here we are. It's the same kind of argument that the interpretation of what this mitigating factor means or what this aggravating factor means makes a sentence an abuse of discretion. So that reasoning opens up the state to appeal all sorts of sentences that now it can't appeal.
But there is a principal distinction, isn't there not, based on the statutes of the factors and the way that the trial court has the discretion to weigh those factors, and a prerequisite kind of
I think once we collapse statute. The distinction between illegality and abuse of discretion, we're looking at a much more porous kind of sentencing schema than we're looking at. And I'd say also that 44.1 says the trial court has to consider specific aggravating factors. It has to consider each. Let's say the trial court doesn't consider one. That is mandatory language in the statute, and the state thinks that that aggravating factor applies in this case. Why isn't that an illegal sentence? Because the trial court didn't consider these facts. But again, under my second theory of legality, at least if the trial court makes each finding of the 9 and B, then we have a legal sentence still. And, you know, as this court said in Acevedo, floodgates could open for PCR, floodgates could open for motions to correct an illegal sentence, which are not time barred. These two concepts have been different for a very long time, and it's a distinction with a difference, and I would ask for this court to maintain that distinction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kamisiak.
I just have a few quick points in rebuttal. The first is that we heard a lot about discretionary determinations and abuse of discretion. I just want to make clear that there's nothing discretionary in 2C35-14 about the fact that a judge must make the 9 findings in order for a defendant to be sentenced to special probation. These are all mandatory findings that have to be made. There's nothing discretionary about that. And that brings me to my second point. Counsel has argued that the fact that the finding is made is enough, and that simply can't be enough. I set out some examples in my brief, and I'll just give an example to the court now. If for factor about possessing a firearm, factor 5, the mandatory finding that the defendant did not possess a firearm at the time of the present offense or any pending criminal charge. If the judge says that, and even if the judge might even say, I know the defendant had a firearm in this case, the discovery is here, but for humanitarian reasons, I want this defendant to get into drug court. And we've seen that happen. Judges disregarding evidence in order to get to a result, that wouldn't be able to be appealed, and that should not be the result. So just the fact that the finding is made cannot be enough. The finding has to be supported by law and the facts.
Talk to us about interlocutory appeals.
Sure. So interlocutory appeals, I mean, at a bare minimum, we would ask this court to clarify, because I think Highland suggests that there's no review whatsoever if it's read broadly. At a bare minimum, the state should have the ability to have an interlocutory appeal, but the state believes strongly that we have the right to appeal as of right because these are mandatory findings. Interlocutory appeals may not work in all instances. A judge could change their mind. We don't know what's going to happen. A judge could make findings. The state throughout this objected and intended to argue and did argue at sentencing that the defendant was a danger to the community and hoped to change the judge's mind, and he still made that finding. So to say that we could appeal, move for relief to appeal only in this limited window and then it's forever lost doesn't really make sense. But at a bare minimum, if the court were to disagree with the right to appeal, we would ask for clarification that there is this ability to move for relief to appeal.
In your experience, can you give us a sense of how long the window is?
I can't really speak to other cases. I haven't seen a lot of cases. And again, I mean, in this case, there was a finding by the judge in December, I believe. December, let me just get my timeline. In December, December 9th, 2016 was the drug court appeal. And then she pled on January 20th, 2017, and the sentencing was on February 23rd, 2017. But the state believed that it would have the right to appeal at the end of the day if the judge still imposed the sentence. So that shouldn't be held against the state, and that we're forever, precluded from seeking this appeal and review of what we contend is an illegal sentence. And just on that note, DeGroote, the case that's cited in our appendix, one of the cases, the appellate division found the state had an appeal as of right, and that was a Track 2 case. And we're asking for that same type of analysis to apply. The state has an appeal as of right. And that's what makes sense, and that's what the legislature, this doesn't go against the legislature's intent. If anything, this is effectuating the legislature's intent to only allow certain candidates into drug court. And just one final point about the leave to appeal. I mean, we've been talking about pleas, and a defendant is probably not going to plead unless they know the judge is inclined to grant drug court. Drug court is a sentencing option, so it could be imposed after a trial. So that adds a whole other layer of wrinkle into this whole interlocutory versus right to appeal as of right.
But would there be a finding first? I mean, this is obviously this is meaningful.
Right.
There has to be some gap that's longer that I know. I'm sure you're quick with your motions for leave to appeal, but probably an hour would be a little bit tough.
Yes.
Is there a finding, an event on which the court makes findings on the record?
Mm-hmm.
In a trial setting,
mm-hmm.
that would precede by some days or mm-hmm. weeks
mm-hmm.
the sentencing?
I know that did happen here. I can't say definitively that would happen in all cases.
It may not, because the person
right.
pleads guilty to the elements of the offense. The court on its own may just generally say, I'm inclined to put you in drug court without making any findings. And
yes.
it would be on the day of sentence.
Yes, correct.
That you would find out whether or not the judge agreed or not agreed, right?
Correct. I would agree with that, and that's why, our first position is that we should have an appeal as of right. Also, the appellate division, because the bar is so high for motion for leave to appeal, may not at first blush grant it, but, I mean, I guess we would then be precluded from seeking an appeal as of right. I mean, I don't think that would make sense.
You, of course, I thought there was a concession that if a factor such as number one was not met,
mm-hmm.
the right of appeal would exist. So if there were no professional diagnostic assessment done, period, that's similar to ANCRA, one could argue.
Mm-hmm.
You'd know. You'd know if a diagnostic assessment had been done.
Yes, you would know. Yeah, you'd have the report or not. And I think counsel also said...
And that would give you a window, is what I'm getting at.
For leave to appeal?
you'd be aware of this process. You'd know that this was under consideration, certainly.
Sure. I mean, there has to be a diagnostic assessment done of the defendant in order for them to be admitted into drug court. I mean, there could be some situation where perhaps a judge just puts them into... There could be a situation where a judge just says, I'm putting them into drug court without the assessment. I mean, we would hope that doesn't happen, but, I mean, things...
Right, and then you'd have an easier route to appeal is what I was getting at.
Yes. I mean, yes, I do understand the court's point. But I think the defendant's position is that we can't have any right to appeal as of right. And the state feels strongly that we do have an appeal as of right. I don't think I have anything else at this time, unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.